14. I have no idea what this is about, Floyd said, but where I come from, it's customary to knock. But we did, the young inspector said pleasantly. I meant knock and then wait to be invited in. As a matter of fact, you might even try calling ahead to make an appointment. It's called common courtesy. The inspector smiled, but we did. Unfortunately, the line was busy whenever we tried. Of course, that convinced us that there was someone home now. Otherwise, we would have paid you a visit later this afternoon. And the purpose of this visit is what? My apologies, the young plainclothes man said. I am Inspector Belliard of the crime squad. He stopped in front of Floyd's desk and picked up a black china paperweight in the shape of a horse that had been holding a ream of typed and carbon copy documentation in check. Nice antique, Belliard said. It would make a wonderful blunt instrument. He tossed the horse to one of his partners, who fumbled the catch and let it drop to the floor, where it shattered into a dozen jagged pieces. Floyd fought to keep a lid on his temper. The one thing they clearly wanted him to do was lose it badly. That almost looked deliberate, he said. Of course. We both know it was an accident. I'll write you a chit for it. You can claim compensation at the quay. Do they hand out chits for electrocution burns? I might need one of those as well. What an odd question, Belliard said, smiling thinly. He moved to the window, pulling back the blinds to examine the view. Floyd noticed that for a moment neither Belliard nor his men had their eyes on his desk. He used the instant to slip Custine's letter back under the telephone, hoping that none of the men would notice the sudden movement or the slight chime as the handset resettled on its cradle. I guess you're here to harass my partner, Floyd said. Belliard turned from the window, blowing a line of dust from his fingers. Harass your colleague, Monsieur Floyd. Why on earth would we want to do that? Because it's what you've always done? The young man scratched the tip of his nose. He had a very slender face, nearly hairless, like one of the dummies Floyd frequently saw in the windows of gentlemen's outfitters. Even his eyebrows appeared to have been penciled in. Funny you should mention your partner, the man said, because it's Custine we were hoping to have a chat with. I know all about your little chats, Floyd said. They usually involve a quick trip to the bottom of the stairs. You're much too cynical, Belliard said, chidingly. It doesn't become you, Monsieur Floyd. I've grown into it like an old shoe. These are new times, a new Paris. Floyd picked up a pencil and rolled it between his fingers. I think I preferred the old one. It smelled better. Then maybe you should air out the place a little, Belliard said, opening the office window. A sudden stiff breeze blew through the room, sending papers flying onto the carpet and slamming shut the main and connecting doors. Belliard turned from the window and walked towards Floyd, making no effort to avoid the case notes and paperwork now littering the floor. There, better already. It wasn't the city that had a bad smell about it. It was your office. If you say so. Let's stop playing games, shall we? Belliard moved back to the side of the desk directly opposite Floyd and planted the heels of his hands on the edge of it. He was looking Floyd straight in the eye. There's been a murder in the Blanchard building. I know, Floyd said. I'm the poor sap investigating it. Not that one. I mean the one that happened about 3 hours ago. I don't follow. Blanchard is dead. He was found on the pavement beneath his balcony, just like the unfortunate Mademoiselle White. Belliard looked at one of his men. You know, perhaps there was something in that business after all. Genuinely shocked, despite the forewarning in Custine's message, Floyd found it difficult to form the words he wanted to say. Blanchard's dead. Blanchard's actually been murdered. Belliard looked at him with pale, discriminating eyes, as if judging the exact degree by which Floyd was surprised. Yes, he said, his thin, bloodless lips moving, but the sound reaching Floyd delayed, as if traveling across a great divide. And the unfortunate thing is that the last person seen in his presence was your associate, Custine. As a matter of fact, he was observed leaving the building in something of a rush. Custine didn't do it, Floyd said automatically. You sound astonishingly sure of that. How could you possibly know that, unless the man himself had offered you an explanation or an alibi? Because I know Custine. I know he wouldn't do something like that. Floyd's throat was suddenly dry. Without asking anyone's permission, he poured himself a sip of brandy and knocked it back. How can you be so certain? Do you have that much insight into his character? I have all the insight I need, Floyd snapped, and it wouldn't matter a damn whether I did or not, because it still wouldn't make any sense. Blanchard took us on to solve his homicide case. Why would one of us murder our own client? Maybe there was always an ulterior motive, Belliard said, or perhaps the murder was completely impulsive, an act of sudden blinding rage, entirely without premeditation. Not Custine, Floyd said. His eyes drifted to the telephone, where the slip of white paper was still jutting out visibly from underneath the base, in spite of his attempt to hide it. Belliard couldn't see it from his present angle, and might not make anything of it if he could. But if he did notice it, Floyd felt nausea flood through him like water through the Hoover Dam. No matter what he may have told you, André Custine was a violent man, Belliard said, almost sympathetically. A man died in custody under his questioning. You knew that, didn't you? An innocent man, as it happened. Not that his innocence would have been much consolation while Custine was breaking every finger on one of his hands. No, Floyd said aghast. I see from your expression that he didn't tell you. What a shame. All this might have been avoided otherwise. Feeling detached from himself, as if bobbing above his body like an invisible balloon, Floyd said, What do you mean? Simply that Blanchard might still be alive. Evidently, Custine lost it again. Belliard pursed his lips disapprovingly, as if being forced to listen to an off-color joke. There's no telling what might have set him off. Don't you idiots get it? Floyd said. There was one homicide connected with the Susan White case, and now there's been another. Don't go trying to pin this on Custine just because of his past, just because you and he have some unfinished business. You'll be going after the wrong man while the right man gets away with it again. A nice theory, Belliard said, and I'd be tempted to give it the time of day if there wasn't one niggling little detail out of place. Floyd closed the telephone directory, trying to make the action seem as casual and automatic as possible, which is, if your man Custine is the innocent party here, just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, then why was he in such a hurry to leave the scene of the crime? I don't know, Floyd said. You'll have to ask him that yourselves. No, actually I do know. Custine was no fool. He'd have known exactly how you'd try to pin this on him for old time's sake. Then you allow that he may have fled the scene. I allow nothing, Floyd said. When was the last time you saw Custine? This morning. Floyd noticed that one of the other officers was writing notes in a spiral-bound notebook with a black marbled fountain pen. I dropped him at the Blanchard place while I went off to make some other inquiries. Some other inquiries? Belliard repeated, a mocking note in his voice. That does sound so very professional, when you put it like that. What was Custine supposed to be doing? Floyd shrugged. At this point he saw no need to lie. There was something about the White case that bothered us. Custine needed to get a better look at the wireless set in her room. And that was the last time you saw him or heard from him. I tried calling the Blanchard apartment not long before you arrived. No one picked up. Belliard looked at Floyd with an amused glint in his eye. That doesn't quite answer my question. Floyd reminded himself that the last thing he should do was lose his temper with these K-men, and forced himself to speak calmly and civilly, like a man with nothing to hide. That was the last contact I had with Custine. Very well, Belliard said. And was there any sign that Custine had been here in your absence? He's your associate, so I presume he has his own key to your premises. There's no sign that he's been back. Nothing disturbed? Nothing missing? No messages? Nothing like that, Floyd said, as wearily as he dared. Belliard motioned for the other officer to snap shut his notebook. We are done here, I think. He reached into his jacket and pulled out a business card. Now it's my turn. We found one of your business cards on Blanchard's body, and another turned up with the witness who saw Custine fleeing the scene. By way of reciprocity, here's my card. Floyd took it. Any particular reason why I might need this? Custine may try to contact you. It's not unusual, especially if someone's just gone on the run. He may need personal items. He may need funds. He may wish to put his side of the story to a friend. You'll be the first person I call if that happens. Make sure that I am. Belliard reached for his hat, then stopped himself. I almost forgot. There's a small favor I need to ask of you. I'm all ears. I need to use your telephone. We have a team still sweeping the crime scene, and I'd like to call them before I make my next move, just in case they've turned something up. There's a wireless in the car, but it's a long walk downstairs, and I won't be able to call through to Blanchard's apartment directly. Go right ahead, Floyd said, feeling his blood temperature drop about 10 degrees. I hope that counts as cooperating with your inquiries. Belliard lifted the receiver from its cradle and started dialing. Very much so. And don't let me walk out of here without signing you a chit for that horse. The edge of Custine's letter glared at Floyd, peeking out from underneath the telephone like a flag of surrender. If they found that note, Floyd thought, then he and Custine were both as good as dead. They would take Floyd down into the quay and make life unpleasant for him until he gave them some lead that would bring them Custine. And if he died before they got it out of him, they'd simply make sure they had enough men on the job to cover all the possibilities. They had scented blood now, the chance to punish Custine for the way he had betrayed them all, in spirit, if not in name, before his enforced retirement. It had been a long time coming, and they were not going to be in the most forgiving frame of mind. Belliard started speaking, his French almost too rapid and clipped for Floyd to follow. It was French with a heavy seasoning of police jargon, almost another language in its own right. The inspector leaned against the table and began to drag the telephone towards him by fractions of an inch, gradually exposing more and more of the letter. He's going to see it any second now, Floyd thought, and he isn't going to be able to resist taking a look at it. It's what anyone would do in the same circumstances. He heard someone try the outer door but find it locked. A voice called out in thick peasant French. Belliard motioned for one of the officers to open the door, while he continued speaking. Floyd picked up snatches of Belliard's side of the conversation, something about the wireless itself being smashed to pieces on the pavement, along with Blanchard, and it sounded as if it had been a violent death this time, with no attempt to make it look like anything other than murder. The second officer reached the outer door and unlocked it. He opened it a crack, and Floyd saw another officer standing there, a man who must have been waiting in the car downstairs. Floyd had a moment to register this scene, and then the door was wrenched violently from the officer's hand as another gale suddenly tore through the apartment, snatching into the air the few papers that hadn't already found their way to the floor. In that squall of flying paper, Floyd saw the note from Custine flutter out from under the telephone, across the room, and out through the open window, like a moth on the wing. Belliard concluded his call and returned the telephone to Floyd's desk. "Perhaps I shouldn't have opened that window after all," he said, looking down at the carpet of disheveled papers. "It'll take you a month of Sundays to tidy up this lot." "That's all right," Floyd said, wondering how obvious his relief was. It was about time they had a good sort. Belliard reached into his jacket and pulled out a book of chits. "How much for the horse?" "Don't worry about it," Floyd said. "I was going to throw it out anyway." After he had locked the door behind the K-men, Floyd moved to the window, still open to the mid-afternoon city, and peeled aside the dusty slats of the blinds. He watched a black police sedan below grumble into life and move away. He looked up and down Rue du Dragon, noting the positions and makes of the other vehicles parked there, and paying particular attention to any that he did not recognize, or that seemed out of place in the run-down back street, with its potholes and waterlogged drains. There, three shops up, was another dark sedan. He couldn't tell the model from the angle of his view, but it looked similar to the police car he had just seen depart, probably an unmarked police vehicle. Behind the oily gleam of the windshield, he saw a man sitting patiently with his hands folded in his lap. Floyd had to give them credit. Less than 4 hours had passed since the murder, but the efficient boys from the quay had already assigned a crack team from the crime squad to it. Admittedly, they hadn't had to look very far for a lead, not the way Floyd and Custine had helpfully distributed business cards around the premises, but they had still organized a tail, and maybe more than one. Floyd had an idea of the way the quay worked. If you thought there was one man putting you under surveillance, then there was probably a second or a third you had no idea about. Floyd let the blinds flick back into place. He felt drained, as if he had just staggered to his feet after receiving a stomach punch. Everything had changed since he had walked into the office, laden down with groceries and rather fewer problems than he imagined he had. Why was it never good news that put problems into perspective? Why did it always take another set of problems? He sat back down at his desk and tried to compose his thoughts. The basic details of the investigation remained unchanged, but now it was a double homicide case, and the police had belatedly decided to take an interest. Or, more probably, they had latched on to Blanchard's death as a pretext for punishing Custine. It still didn't look as though they had much interest in the first homicide. But even though the letter was gone, Custine had still given him a vital clue. The typewriter hadn't been a typewriter at all, but a sophisticated piece of enciphering equipment. Several things suddenly made a lot more sense, and they all backed up the spy hypothesis. Susan White had cooked her wireless to tune into coded transmissions. The dots and dashes had looked a lot like Morse, and maybe they were derived from it, but that was only the beginning of the encryption. Morse, as Floyd knew well from his days sailing out of Galveston, was just a way of sending the written word over the airwaves. Anyone with a Morse book could crack that kind of message, even if they had no prior knowledge of the code, which was fine for parlor games, but nowhere near secure enough for spies. That was where the Enigma machine came in. The signals coming over the wireless set had already been scrambled by whoever sent them. White's smashed Enigma machine had been her means of unscrambling those messages back into something readable. It meant that she was definitely a spy. No doubt about that now. It also meant there wasn't a hope in hell of ever learning what was in those Morse transmissions. Floyd snapped out of his reverie and checked the time. 3:30 in the afternoon. Forcing himself into the role of a man who had had no contact with his partner, he decided that his most likely course of action would be to visit the scene of the crime and get the full story for himself. Floyd splashed some water down his throat, then grabbed his hat and coat. He was about to leave Susan White's tin of documents where it was on his desk when a thought flashed into his mind. Whoever had murdered Blanchard had probably been after the tin. First, Susan White had been murdered, and now the landlord. Presumably, whoever had committed the second homicide must now know that the tin was elsewhere. And with all those business cards lying around, it wouldn't take them long to make the connection with Floyd. He picked up the tin. From now on, wherever he went, the tin was coming with him. Floyd turned the Mathis into Rue des Peupliers, slowing as he noticed a trio of police cars gathered near number 23. In his rearview mirror, he noticed the dark sedan he had noticed on Rue du Dragon glide past him towards the junction with Rue de Tolbiac, slowing as the driver noted Floyd's location. The kid pursuing Floyd was an amateur, and Floyd had made no effort to elude him on the drive across town to Blanchard Street. There was almost certainly someone more experienced on the same surveillance detail. Floyd parked halfway up the street, stopped the engine, and observed the scene in silence for a few moments. Although the death had happened at least 5 hours earlier, and probably more like six, there was still a large crowd of onlookers gathered on the sidewalk beneath the balcony. Their shadows were beginning to lengthen in the afternoon light. For a morbid instant, Floyd wondered if the body was still there, crushed and disfigured by the fall. That seemed unlikely, though, and the more Floyd looked, the more obvious it became that the spectators were only gathered around the entrance to the building because they were hoping to snatch a tidbit of forensic gossip from the K officials, police and scientists, who were presumably still coming and going from the crime scene. Floyd smoothed his hair, slipped his hat on, and left the car. He walked up to the gathering of onlookers, recognizing none of them. Two uniformed officers were standing guard at the door, bantering with the crowd. Gently, Floyd pushed his way through the people until he was in plain sight of the policeman. "Can I help you, monsieur?" asked the older of the two officers. Floyd showed the man his identity papers and business card. "I'm a private detective," he said. "Monsieur Blanchard, the late Monsieur Blanchard, happened to be my client." "Bit late then, aren't you?" the officer replied, to a chuckle of approval from his colleague. Floyd tried to sound as breezily unconcerned as the police officer. "Monsieur Blanchard had me investigating an earlier incident that occurred in this building. Now that something's happened to him, I can't help wondering if there's a connection." "Your client's dead," the older officer said. "He had bad breath and a shaving problem. Doesn't that mean no one's paying your wages? He gave me a generous retainer, Floyd said. Anyway, I still have a personal involvement with this case. My associate appears to be the prime suspect. How would you know that? The officer asked. I had a visit from Inspector Belliard. He filled me in. Floyd lowered his voice. Have you talked to these people yet? These aren't the residents. Interviews with the residents are taking place inside. All the same, they might have seen something. They didn't. They'd have said so otherwise. Floyd turned to the people around him. By now he was the focus of attention, rather than the ominous dark smear on the pavement. This is my case as much as theirs, he said, addressing the gathering, making eye contact with as many of them as possible. A woman was murdered here 3 weeks ago, and these bright young things from the Cade didn't bother taking it seriously. Now there's been another suspicious death. Floyd reached into his jacket and pulled out a sheaf of business cards. If any of you people care about preventing a third homicide, now's the chance to do something about it. Think back over the last few days, perhaps the last few weeks if you like, and try to remember anything that struck you as unusual. Maybe it was someone hanging about that you didn't recognize. Maybe even a child. My guess is that whoever was responsible for the first killing had something to do with the second. A middle-aged woman in a droopy hat reached out and took one of the cards from his hand. I saw something, she said. I tried to tell these men, but they weren't interested. Call me, and we'll talk about it, Floyd said. I can tell you now. There was a big man, like a wrestler, very well dressed but all sweaty and out of breath. He came running out into the street and tried to flag down a taxi. There was an argument. Someone else was already waiting for the cab, and the big man didn't like it. They almost came to blows. You saw this? Floyd asked. I heard it. When? The woman looked across the gathering to a male friend. What time was that commotion? I looked at my watch, the other bystander said, taking the burnt-down stub of a cigarette from between his lips. He wore a checkered flat cap and a pencil mustache. It happened at exactly... I didn't ask you. I asked the lady. Floyd turned back to the woman. Did you actually see this happen? I said I heard it, she repeated. A commotion in the street, cars honking their horns, voices raised. But you didn't actually see the big man yourself, he persisted. Not with my own eyes, no, she said, as if this was only a subtle distinction. But he did, she pointed at the man again. And what with the commotion I heard? This is a street in the middle of Paris, Floyd said. You'd be hard-pressed to find a single half-hour when there wasn't some sort of commotion. I know what I saw, the spivvy man said, before pushing the exhausted stub of his cigarette back between his lips. That argument over the taxi, Floyd asked him. Did you notice anything else happening at the same time? The man looked around at his fellow watchers, wary of a trap. No, he said, after due deliberation. Well, that's funny, Floyd said. Because by rights there should have been a body on the sidewalk. Well, there was, the middle-aged woman said, but on a falling note. Before the fight over the taxi, or just afterwards? Think about it carefully, because rather a lot depends on it. While he was speaking, Floyd noticed a younger woman looking at him from the back of the crowd. She kept opening her mouth, as if on the point of saying something, but other people kept interrupting. A man in a butcher's apron raised his hand. Why did you ask about the child just now? Just covering all the bases. I did see a child, a little boy, a very nasty-looking one, hanging around here. Before Floyd could pursue that information, a new voice emerged from the doorway leading into Blanchard's apartment building. Send him inside. We need to talk to him. Floyd quickly handed out the rest of his business cards, urging the witnesses to contact him if they remembered anything else. He watched as someone passed a card to the woman at the back of the crowd. Then he slipped past the two policemen into the dark, mildewed hallway of the apartment building. Hello, Floyd. I notice you've been scattering cards around like confetti lately, the newcomer said, still standing in the shadows. The last time I checked, there wasn't a law against it. You're right to phrase it that way, the man replied. These days one can't be too careful about anything, including the law. Shut the door behind you. Floyd found himself doing as he was told. The man's voice was simultaneously both commanding and reassuring. It was also a voice Floyd had heard before. Inspector Malone? It's been a while, hasn't it? How long ago was the Monceau stabbing? 5, 6 years? At least. An ugly business all round. I'm still not convinced we caught the right man. Floyd's involvement with the case had been tangential. One of his then clients had been linked to the victim, but it had still been enough to bring him into contact with the men from the big house. Politely enough, Malul had told him to stop treading on their steel-capped toes. Floyd had taken the hint. I assume you've already had a nice chat with my colleague, Belliard. He got his point across, Floyd said. Belliard has his methods, I have mine. Malul looked every bit the evil interrogator. He had a thin, drum-tight face, through which the bones of his skull seemed about to burst, a cruel little mouth and crueler little eyes behind rimless glasses. The last 5 or 6 years had done nothing to soften that countenance. He took off his Homburg and scratched at the shaven egg of his scalp. I hope your methods are an improvement, Floyd replied. Your friend is in a great deal of trouble, Malul said, without prevarication. All the more so now that Belliard has taken an interest in the case. I got the impression I wasn't exactly off the hook either. Belliard is one of the bright young things. The right suit, the right hat, the right wife. He even has the right political connections. Chatelier. Who else? Something in the man's tone of voice eased Floyd. I take it you're not exactly singing from the same hymn sheet. Times are changing, Malul said. This is not the same city it was a few years ago. Funny, that's exactly what Belliard said. But he undoubtedly said it as if it was a good thing. Malul slipped his hat back on, pressing it down firmly. It made a scratching sound against the stiff stubble above his ears. I am serious about Belliard. He is not a man of whom you wish to make an enemy. You're his superior. In theory, Malul said. Sadly, I lack both his ambition and his connections. Do you read the papers, Floyd? I keep up with the funny pages. I shouldn't be working this case. Officially, I'm not even here. I'm supposed to be working anti-bootlegging investigations in Montrouge. I read about that. I also heard that you dropped my name when Blanchard was looking for a private eye. You were the obvious choice. I was concerned about the death of the American girl. Something about it didn't add up. But the director of prosecutions was satisfied with the accidental death verdict, so there was nothing I could do. But now the police must take both cases seriously, surely. That depends on whether they want either of them solved or not. Belliard seemed pretty keen to get results. Ah, but what kind of results? He was wrong to ignore the earlier killing. He missed the perfect opportunity to blame her death on some handy minority. But now he has Custine in the frame, he will more than make up for that oversight. He hates Custine that much? They all do. And you? Floyd asked. I knew Custine. We worked together 10 years ago in the 17th. Malul reached inside his jacket and removed a slim metal cigarette case, embossed with a mermaid. He offered a cigarette to Floyd, who declined, before lighting one for himself with a small lighter inlaid with ivory. He was a good detective, a hard man, but always one you could trust. Then you'll know he isn't capable of this. Why did he run in that case? He may have left the scene of the crime, Floyd said, but only because he was smart enough not to hang around. He didn't push Blanchard off his balcony. Someone must have done it, Malul said, tapping ash onto the floor. Your friend is the perfect suspect. It seems that Custine was already in a taxi when the body hit the street, which still doesn't let him off the hook. We don't know until the coroner's report comes in, but it's still entirely possible that he killed Blanchard. I don't see how. He might have stabbed or shot the old man without killing him instantly. He leaves Blanchard in a weakened condition, knowing he won't last long, and rushes downstairs to hail a taxi. Upstairs, meanwhile, Blanchard finds enough strength to stumble around, which unfortunately leads him to fall out of his window. Before Floyd could frame an objection, Malul raised a hand and said, "Merely a scenario, of course. There are others. The point is simply that the observed sequence of events is not necessarily inconsistent with your friend having committed murder. Believe me, I've investigated far stranger cases." "Then maybe you've developed an overactive imagination," Floyd said. "How's this for an alternative scenario? Christine was up there with the old man, either in the same room or nearby. He had every right to be up there, after all. We'd been invited into the building to work the White case. And the trifling matter of Blanchard's death? Someone else did it. Christine witnessed it, or came in too late to do anything about it. Of course he fled. In his position, any sane man would have done the same thing. The law will still take a dim view of it. But you understand, surely, Floyd said, knowing what to do about Christine, about his relationship with his former colleagues. What else could he have done? Malol conceded the point with a downward stab of his cigarette. The fact that I know Christine's history, or might have done the same thing in his shoes, changes nothing. He's innocent, Floyd insisted. But you can't prove it. What if I could? Behind his glasses, Malol widened his cruel, pale eyes the merest fraction. You have something tangible? Not yet, but I'm sure I can put together enough. It will take more than circumstantial evidence to protect him from Belliard. Then I'll find what it takes. You're a reasonable man, Floyd. Malol took a lengthy drag on the cigarette before continuing. I realized as much when our paths crossed over the Monceau case. I told you to back off then, and you did. I appreciated that. And I know you mean well by your partner. For what it's worth, I doubt that Christine did this. But the only thing that will get him off the hook is another suspect. Then I'll find you another suspect. Just like that? Like I said, whatever it takes. Do you have anyone in the frame? If you do, you should tell me immediately. Not doing so could constitute the withholding of evidence. There's no one else in the frame, Floyd said. I wish you were lying for Christine's sake. Malol flicked his spent cigarette to the floor, where he crushed it underfoot. His shoes, Floyd observed, were very scuffed and old. Unfortunately, I rather suspect you are telling the truth. I've only been on the case a couple of days. But now there is no case, Malol said. The man who was employing you is dead. What are you saying? You care about Christine. You may even know where he is. But this is a battle neither of you can win. If Christine has a chance, now is the time for him to leave Paris. That's what I would do. It's only men like Christine who are standing between this city and the wolves. Then perhaps we should all give some thought to leaving, Malol replied. 15. The telephone was ringing when Floyd unlocked the door to his office on the Rue du Dragon. He picked it up with a tinge of trepidation, thinking it might be Christine, but hoping that his partner had more sense than to call him on a number that was more than likely being monitored by the quay. Hello, he said, sitting down behind his desk. Is that Floyd Investigations? The voice on the other end of the line belonged to a woman speaking French, but with an accent he couldn't quite place. My name is Verity Orger. I'm calling about my sister. Floyd sat upright and tore a clean sheet from his pad, scraping the nib of his fountain pen against it until ink blurted out. Your sister? He asked. Susan White, I believe you're investigating her murder. I am indeed, Floyd replied. You can speak English, too, if it's easier. Your French sounds pretty good to my ears, but if we're both Americans... I had a good idea that you were American, she said, switching to English, but it seemed a bit rude to assume too much. How did you hear of me? I was in the crowd on Rue des Peupliers when you handed out those cards, but then I'd also spoken to some of the other tenants, and they'd mentioned that you were asking questions about Susan. I should have spoken to you then, but it's a delicate matter and I didn't want to bring it up in front of all those people. And what delicate matter would that be? I'm calling about my sister's belongings. I understand that poor Mr. Blanchard gave them to you before he... I have them, Floyd said. It's just a box containing some papers, but you're welcome to them. You have my address on that card, right? Rue du Dragon, yes. Do you need directions? No, I'm sure I'll find my way. I can be there within the hour. Would that be all right? Or we can make it later today if that suits you better. Floyd was about to agree to meet her in an hour, but something held him back. He was going to give her the box, no doubt about it, but he also wanted to find out what she did with it when she left his office. With Christine out of action, putting a tail on her was going to be complicated. Greta couldn't take care of it on her own, even if she could be dragged away from Montparnasse at such short notice. Even as he hesitated, a plan began to assemble in his head, but it was not the sort of thing he could throw together in an hour or two. Look, he said quickly, before she grew suspicious, Today is a bit of a problem. I have to leave the office on another case. You're a busy man, Mr. Floyd. He couldn't tell if she was mocking him or quietly impressed. It's nothing too exciting. It would just make things easier if we could make an appointment for first thing tomorrow morning. That sounds perfectly acceptable. 9 o'clock it is, then. See you there, Mr. Floyd. She put down the telephone. Floyd hung up at his end and stared down at the blotted sheet of paper upon which he had written nothing at all. Then he paged through his telephone directory until he found the number for Maurice Didot, the elevator engineer.
He's not broken down again, is it, Monsieur Floyd?
Not exactly, Floyd said, but I'm hoping you might be able to arrange something for me.
I'm not sure I understand.
Can you be here at 8:30 tomorrow morning?
8:30 on a Saturday?
I'll explain everything, Floyd said. I'll also make it worth your while. An hour later, he found Greta in the kitchen in Montparnasse, leafing through a movie magazine while she finished a cigarette. On the cover was a publicity photograph from the latest gloomy policier. She looked up, her eyes tired and her makeup smudged.
I wasn't expecting you so soon.
Floyd closed the door behind him. There's been a development, a real serious development.
Sit down.
She closed the magazine and slid it across the table.
It's Christine, Floyd said.
What about him?
He's on the run.
This had better not be some kind...
Do I sound as if I'm joking? He said sharply. Monsieur Blanchard is dead.
Monsieur who?
The landlord of the building on Rue des Peupliers. The man Susan White entrusted with that box of papers. The man who employed Christine and me to prove she was murdered. They found him dead on the sidewalk this morning. Floyd pulled up a chair and sat across the table from her.
No,
she said softly.
Yes, and Christine happened to be in the building carrying out the investigation at the time.
Surely you don't think he had anything to do with it?
Floyd buried his head in his hands. I want to believe he didn't. Everything I thought I knew about the man says he couldn't have done this.
Well then?
But he was supposed to talk to the landlord about the possibility that he might have killed Susan White. Not by confronting him directly, but just nose around the question to rule it out.
Did you seriously think...
We had to exclude the possibility, just because he seemed like a kindly old man with a plausible story.
But you told me the police weren't even interested in investigating the girl's death. Why would the old man risk the finger of suspicion pointing his way?
Christine and I wondered if he really wanted to be found out. If he killed her for attention and didn't get it, of course he'd want to hire us.
You need nasty, suspicious minds in your line of work.
It wasn't just a hypothesis, Floyd said defensively. The point is that I authorized Christine to turn up the heat on Blanchard, and a few hours later they find Blanchard face down on the sidewalk.
You think Christine may have probed too deeply?
We're talking about a man who used to work interrogation duty at the Quay, a man who specialized in the application of fear and pain to get a result. Someone's been putting doubts in your mind. Floyd gazed at her through his fingers. Today I heard something about Christine that I didn't know before.
Let me guess, one of Christine's former colleagues had a little word with you?
He said that an innocent man died in his custody, under questioning.
Do you believe that?
I have no reason not to believe it.
Christine's your friend, Floyd.
I know, and I feel lousy for even thinking that he might have had something to do with Blanchard's death, but I can't help the way my mind works.
Were there any witnesses?
People saw Christine fleeing the scene. That may or may not have been before the body hit the street. Someone else saw a strange little boy.
And that's supposed to mean something?
Strange little children keep turning up in this case like bad pennies.
You think a child might have done this?
I think a child might be involved, but I don't know how. I don't know why. Greta ground out the cigarette on her ashtray, then tapped the edge with coal black fingernails.
Forget the children for a moment. Have you had any contact with Christine?
Not in person, but he left a note in my office. He must have gone there straight away, as soon as he realized how much trouble he was in. Floyd sat back in his chair and picked his shirt away from his chest. It was sodden with sweat, as if he had been running around on a hot summer day. Forcing some semblance of calm into his voice, he said, I'd only just had time to read the message when I got a visit from one of the boys from the big house. Lovely fellow by the name of Belliard, and two of his henchmen.
I've never heard of him.
Hope you never do. He's got a real bee in his bonnet about Christine,
and I think he'd like to take me down at the same time. What did he say? He wanted to know if I'd had any contact with Custine. I lied, of course. But they know Custine's bound to get in touch with me sooner or later. She scrutinized him long and hard before framing her next question. And what does Custine want from you?
Nothing. He says he can take care of himself.
But he's your friend, she said again. My friend, too. We have to help him. Floyd studied her face, trying to read her mood. How is Marguerite? Do you really want to know, or are you just changing the subject?
I really want to know, he said. Do you think the situation in Paris is getting as bad as she says?
It's clearly not getting any better.
Malol said more or less the same thing when I ran into him at Blanchard's place. It's frightening that such a change could creep up on us unnoticed.
I'm sure people said the same thing 20 years ago.
You're thinking of Marguerite's comment about the weeds coming back?
Yes,
she said simply.
Maybe she's right. Maybe it takes an old person's perspective to see things so clearly.
All the more reason to leave, Greta said.
Unless people do something about it here, now, before it's too late.
People like you, Floyd?
She had difficulty hiding her amusement.
People like us, he said.
There's something else, isn't there?
Yes. I've heard from Susan White's sister. She telephoned the office just before I drove over.
It's quite a day for developments.
What did she want?
The tin.
Are you going to let her have it?
I want her to have it, but I also want to tail her when she leaves the office. For that, I'm going to need a little bit of help.
I see.
Will you do it? If not for me, then for Custine.
Don't push your luck, Floyd.
I mean it. Malol said he could get Custine off the hook if I could come up with something tangible.
Like what?
Another suspect. I know it's a long shot, but the girl's my only lead. If I don't follow her, Custine's finished. Floyd and Greta pushed through the doors into Le Perroquet Pourpre and followed the line of framed jazz photographs that led downstairs into the basement. At 8 on a Friday evening, a few regulars had already arrived, but otherwise the place was quiet, with most of the tables still unoccupied. A young kid in a striped shirt was playing East St. Louis Toodaloo solo on the house piano, trying to match Duke's moves but not quite getting there. Michelle nodded coolly at Floyd and Greta, served them drinks without saying a word, and went back to polishing the zinc-topped bar. Every now and then he'd raise an eye to the door at the top of the stairs leading down into the room, as if expecting someone else. Floyd and Greta sipped their drinks without speaking. 5 minutes passed, then 10.
You know why we're here, Floyd said eventually.
Michelle stopped polishing and made a big show of putting aside his towel.
You take the easy route getting here?
No one followed us, Floyd assured him.
You're sure of that?
As sure as I can be.
That's not much of a guarantee.
It's the best I can give you. You know where he is, don't you? Michelle took their empty glasses.
Follow me.
He raised a folding section of counter at the end of the bar and led them into a back room full of casks and empty wine bottles. Another door led into a meandering brick corridor lined with wooden beer crates. Halfway down this corridor, Michelle stopped at an unmarked white door and fished out a set of keys. He opened the door and stepped into another storage room, also piled high with crates. They appeared to fill the room to the back wall, but when Floyd looked closely, he saw that the crates had been arranged to conceal another door.
Through here, Michelle said. Keep it quick and keep it quiet. No offense, Floyd, but I'm taking a serious risk here.
And it's appreciated, Floyd assured him. The concealed door admitted them to a tiny room not much larger than a broom cupboard. The walls were covered with flaking plaster, which was coming off in scabs to reveal damp, cracked brickwork. A single electric light bulb provided illumination. A mattress on the floor was the only item of furniture. Half lying on this mattress, his back propped against the wall with only a few thin pillows for comfort, was Custine. A bag of provisions sat by his side. He wore the same clothes he'd had on that morning, but now they were crumpled, sweat-stained, and disheveled, as if he'd had them on for a week. Custine placed aside a scrap of newspaper he'd been reading.
Don't mistake this for ingratitude, he said. But how did you find me?
Lucky guess, Floyd replied.
Or rather a process of deduction, Greta said. How many friends do we have left in this city?
Not many, Custine admitted. So it wasn't that difficult to draw up a shortlist. Michelle was pretty near the top.
It's good of him to keep me here, Christine said, but I can't stay for long. It's too dangerous for him and too dangerous for me.
I take it you weren't
followed? No, Floyd said. I'm in a lot of trouble.
Then it's up to us to do what we can to get you out of it, Greta said.
But first we have to know what happened, Floyd added. All of it, Andre, from the moment I dropped you off at Rue des Peupliers this morning.
Did you get my note?
Of course.
Then you know about the typewriter.
The enciphering machine, yes. What I don't quite understand is...
We used them at the quay, Christine said, for secure communications between different establishments when we were trying to crack major organized crime operations, the kind of people who tap out telephone lines. When Blanchard showed us the typewriter case, at least what he thought was a typewriter case, I knew I'd seen one like it before. It was just a question of remembering when and where.
I'm glad you did, Floyd said. It cleared up a few things.
She was a spy.
I agree.
And she wasn't acting alone, either. Not if someone else is still sending those coded transmissions. She almost certainly has associates in the area.
As a matter of fact, Floyd said, one of them's due to walk into the office at 9 tomorrow morning.
Christine's eyes widened.
The sister?
She showed up, just like Blanchard said she would.
Be very, very careful how you play this, Christine warned.
I've got the matter in hand. Now, I'd like to hear your side of the story. What the hell happened today?
Christine rearranged himself on the mattress. I began my investigations on the second floor, with the tenant you didn't manage to speak to yesterday. He still wasn't in, so I proceeded to Mademoiselle White's room, and once again set about trying to record those radio transmissions.
Did you get anything?
Yes, and this time I had the benefit of a Morse book. But as I transcribed the message, it became clear that it was meaningless, just a random sequence of letters. I stared at them, until something about them began to seem oddly familiar. That was when I remembered the Enigma machine in the quay. It hit me then. It was utterly pointless trying to extract any information from the message. Even if we managed to get our hands on an intact Enigma machine of the same kind that Susan White was using, we would still have no idea of the particular settings that would need to be applied to decipher the message.
Floyd scratched his head. How long would it take us to work through all the possibilities?
Christine shook his head dismissively. Years, Floyd. The encryption's not meant to be easily broken. That's the whole point.
So this whole wireless business was a wild goose chase.
On the contrary, it told us rather a lot about Susan White, even if it didn't tell us what was in those messages. We also know that someone made a point of smashing her Enigma machine. Whoever did that knew exactly how important it was.
So she was killed by an enemy agent, Floyd speculated.
I think we can assume so, Christine replied. And whoever did that must have destroyed the rotor settings for the machine as well. Nothing in the tin she entrusted to Blanchard resembles a list of such settings. They may have been written down elsewhere. She may even have committed them to memory.
Talking of Blanchard, Floyd prompted.
When the futility of intercepting those signals dawned on me, I put the wireless back as I'd found it the day before, complete with broken connections. I packed away my tools and set off down to Blanchard's rooms, where I intended to bring up the delicate matter we discussed yesterday.
And did you?
I never got a chance, Christine said. When I knocked on the door to his rooms, I found it ajar. I pushed it open and called out to him. No one answered, but I heard sounds.
What sort of sounds?
Scuffling, grunting, furniture being moved around. Naturally, I entered. That was when I saw the child. A little girl. Perhaps the one we saw outside the apartment yesterday. Perhaps another one.
What was the child doing? Asked Floyd, a sick feeling beginning to churn in his stomach.
It was killing Monsieur Blanchard.
Christine said this with a perfect detached calm, as if he had gone over the events in his head too many times to be shocked by them any more.
Blanchard was on the floor, with his head pressed against the leg of a chair. The child was squatting over him, holding one hand over his mouth, while it grasped a clawed fire iron in the other. It was smashing the fire iron against his skull.
How could a child overpower a man like that? Floyd asked. He was elderly, but he wasn't particularly frail.
All I can report is what I saw, Christine said. The child seemed to have enormous animal strength. It had stick-thin arms and legs, but was still hammering that fire iron down on him as if he'd had the strength of a blacksmith.
You keep calling the child it, Floyd observed.
It looked at me, Christine said. That was when I knew it wasn't any kind of child.
Greta looked at Floyd, concern filling her eyes. Floyd reached out and touched her arm reassuringly.
Go on, he said to Christine. It was dressed like a little girl, but when it looked at me, I knew it was something else, something more like a demon than a child. Its face reminded me of a piece of shriveled fruit. When it opened its mouth, I saw a dry black tongue and a few rotten stubs of teeth. I smelled it.
He's frightening me, Greta said, shuddering with revulsion under Floyd's hand. Is this supposed to be one of those children you say keep turning up?
Whatever they aren't children, Christine repeated. They're things that resemble children unless you look closely, that's all.
This isn't possible, Greta insisted.
We've both seen them, Floyd said. So did some of the tenants in Blanchard's building.
But children?
Somehow they fit into this, Floyd said. One of them probably killed Susan White.
What happened next?
Greta asked, fascination gradually overcoming apprehension.
The child looked at me, Christine said. He reached into the little bag of provisions next to his mattress and took out a bottle of whiskey, helping himself to a nip. It looked at me and made a sound I will never forget. It opened its mouth. That was when I saw the tongue and teeth, and it sang.
He said the word with distaste, washing it from his mouth with another slug of whiskey.
What do you mean it sang? Floyd asked. Or wailed or shrieked. I really can't describe it adequately. It was not the sound a child was ever meant to make, like a kind of monstrous yodel. Don't ask me how, but I knew what it was doing. It was calling out to others like itself, summoning them.
Christine screwed the top back on the bottle and returned it to the bag.
That was when I fled.
You knew that would look bad.
Nothing would have been as bad as staying in that room. I looked around for a weapon, but the child thing already had the one item in the room capable of doing any damage. I just wanted to get as far away from there as possible.
You hailed a taxi?
Yes, Christine said. I took it straight to Rue de Dragon, where I left you the note. Then I came here.
The men from the big house think you killed Blanchard, Floyd said.
Of course they do. It's what they want to believe. Have they spoken to you?
I had a real nice chat with an Inspector Belliard shortly after you fled the scene.
Belliard is poison. Protect yourself, Floyd. Have nothing more to do with the case. Have nothing more to do with me.
Bit late for that.
It's never too late for common sense.
Well, maybe this time it is. I spoke to our old friend Malul. He was skeptical, but deep down I'm pretty sure he thinks you're innocent.
Christine shook his head resignedly. One good man can't help any of us.
I told him I'd clear your name. He said he'd look at any evidence I was able to turn up.
I'm warning you, as a friend, leave this whole business alone. Do what I intend to do, which is to get out of Paris at the earliest opportunity.
There's nowhere for you to run, Floyd said. I can hop on the flying boat and be in America 2 days later.
You can't. Wherever you go in France, the men from the Quai will find you eventually.
Our only hope is to clear your name.
Then you have set yourself an impossible task.
If I give Malol one of those children, things might look a bit different.
No one will believe that a child was capable of those murders.
But if enough witnesses come forward, enough people who've seen one of these demons hanging around, that might change things.
Floyd, Christine said with sudden urgency, please use your head. Those things are out there even as we speak. They are in the city. They move without attracting suspicion. Furthermore, they seem to be doing their utmost to kill anyone who had the slightest connection with Susan White, which now includes the three of us.
Then I guess that makes it personal, Floyd said.
Drop the case, my friend. Drop the case and go with Greta to America.
Not yet. Like I said, I've already got an interview lined up with the sister.
You are playing with fire.
No, Floyd said. I'm playing with the only lead left in this whole case. And the only thing that's going to lead me to those children and get you off the hook.
Christine slumped back against the wall. I can't argue with you, can I?
It's no more than you do for me.
Which only goes to show that we both lack common sense.
It's overrated anyway, Floyd replied, smiling.
Be careful, Christine said. Those children may be demons,
but there's no guarantee that the sister isn't just as dangerous.
At 9 the next morning, Floyd watched Veritiorgo walk into his office. The slatted light shining through the blinds caught her from one side, electric silver highlights dancing on every curve and curl. She wore a dark, pinstriped business suit with low-heeled shoes, and if she had arrived with a hat, she must have hung it up outside. Her neatly parted light hair fell in a straight line down to her shoulders and then flounced back up at the ends, as if it had changed its mind at the last moment. Her hair made Floyd think of the flukes of whales in old Dutch lithographs. She had very fine eyebrows, and her face seemed to shift from severe to serene and back again between heartbeats. She had already helped herself to a seat before it occurred to Floyd that she really did not look very much like her sister. "I'm sorry about the state of my office," Floyd said, indicating the piles of barely sorted paperwork. "Someone decided it needed rearranging."
"You needn't apologize," Orga said, resting her handbag on her lap. "I'm just grateful that you've agreed to see me at such short notice."
She looked him squarely in the eye. "I appreciate that this is all very unusual, Mr. Floyd."
"There's nothing usual where a homicide's concerned," he said, "and I don't imagine any of this has been easy on you."
"I won't pretend it's been easy," she said. "On the other hand, I won't pretend that Susan and I were the closest of sisters either."
"Family trouble?"
"Nothing so dramatic. We were just never very close when we were growing up. We were half-sisters, for a start. Susan's father died before I was born. She was 4 years older than me, which might not sound much, but it's a world of difference when you're children. Susan may as well have been a grown-up for all that we had in common."
"And later, when you were both older?"
"I suppose the age difference became less important, but by then Susan was spending less and less time at home. She was always running off with boys, bored out of her mind with our little town."
"Tanglewood, Dakota," Floyd said, nodding. Her eyes widened in what was either mild surprise or mild disbelief.
"You know it?"
"I know of it,
but only because of what I learned from the papers in your sister's tin. Funny thing is, I looked it up in a gazetteer and it doesn't seem to exist."
"You mean it wasn't in the gazetteer?"
"I assure you it exists, Mr. Floyd. I would have a great deal of trouble explaining my childhood if it didn't. Do you have an ashtray?"
Floyd passed her one. "It must be a real one-horse town."
Orga shook her head as she lit a cigarette.
"It has wild ambitions of becoming a one-horse town."
"Like that, is it? In which case I understand why your sister felt she had to leave. A place like that can begin to feel like a prison.
Where are you from, if you don't mind my asking? I don't even know your first name."
"I'm from Galveston, Texas," Floyd said. "My father was a merchant marine. I was a trawlerman by the time I was 16.
"And you ended up in Paris?"
Orga blew out a line of smoke. "I hope you weren't the navigator."
"I was the navigator, wireless operator, and a lot of other things until the day I decided I liked making music more than catching fish. I'd just turned 19 and I'd heard that Paris was the place to be if you wanted to make it as a musician, especially if you were American. Boucher was here, Baker, Gershwin. So I caught a boat to Marseille and decided to try to make my name. I landed in 1939, a year before the tanks rolled into the Ardennes."
"And?"
"I'm still trying to make my name."
Floyd puffed out his cheeks and smiled. "I gave up on my serious jazz ambitions after about 6 months. I still play as a hobby, and now and then I make more money out of it than I do from the detective business, but I'm afraid that's more of a sad reflection on the business than my luck as a musician."
"How did you get into this line of work?"
"It's something of a jump from trawlerman to private detective."
"It didn't happen overnight," Floyd replied, "but I had an advantage before I even landed. My mother was French, and I had the paperwork to prove it. The French army was undermanned and unprepared for the German army lining up on the border. When they finally woke up and realized they were being invaded, they weren't too fussy about who they let into the country."
"And did you man those guns?"
"I told them I'd think about it."
"And?"
"I thought about it and decided there were things I'd rather be doing than waiting around for German 77s to pound the hell out of me."
Auger abandoned her cigarette, barely smoked, stubbing it out in the ashtray.
"Didn't the authorities come after you?"
"There were no authorities. The government had already cut and run, leaving a city run by mobsters. For a while back there, it really looked as if the German invasion was going to succeed. It was only luck that those armored divisions got bogged down in the Ardennes. Bad weather, working for us, for once.
That and the fact that we realized they were in trouble in time to put some bombers over them.
A close thing, in other words. It almost makes you wonder what would have happened if that advance hadn't stalled.
Maybe it wouldn't have been so bad, Floyd said. At least there'd have been some kind of order under the Germans. Still, it was the right outcome as far as I was concerned. There was a lot of dirty work to go around. A man who could speak American and French and pass as either was very valuable in those days.
Olga nodded. I can imagine.
Floyd waved a hand, compressing years of his life into a single dismissive gesture. I got a job as a bodyguard and chauffeur for a local gangster. They taught me more ropes than I ever knew existed. When the local gangster opposition wiped out my boss, I made a couple of sideways moves and found myself running a small, struggling detective agency. Shouldn't there be another chapter? The one where you end up running a huge, successful detective agency with branches all around the world?
Maybe next year, he said, smiling ruefully.
I like your attitude, Mr. Floyd. You don't seem to feel that the world owes you a living.
It doesn't. I've played jazz with some of the best musicians alive, and I've seen them paid in bottles of medicinal alcohol, which they gladly sucked down until they went blind from it. While I still have a roof over my head, I can't feel too sorry for myself. This little operation won't make me or my partner Christine rich men, but somehow or other we stumble on from year to year.
Actually, and this is going to sound somewhat indelicate, it's your little operation I came to talk to you about, or rather one particular investigation being conducted by your agency.
I wondered when the small talk was going to end. Pity, I was actually beginning to enjoy it. Shall we get to Susan's belongings?
He could see the relief on her face. You have them, then. I was so worried when I heard about what happened to her landlord.
I have the box she gave him for safekeeping, Floyd said. I don't have anything else, and it's only good luck that I have the box.
Why did Mr. Blanchard give it to you?
He thought the contents might shed some light on why she was killed. The old man was pretty convinced she was murdered.
Olga sighed. Well, I can understand why he might feel that way. But it wasn't murder.
You know that for a fact?
I knew my sister, not well, as I've already told you, but well enough not to be surprised that this happened.
Floyd opened the desk drawer and took out the biscuit tin. He placed it on the desk between himself and Olga, then removed the metal lid so that she could see the items inside.
Go on, he said. Susan had problems, even when she was still living at home. She was always getting into trouble, always making up stories to suit whichever version of the truth she wanted people to believe at a particular moment. Her and half the human race. The trouble with Susan was that she didn't know where to stop. She was a fantasist, Mr. Floyd, living in a dream world of her own making, and it only became worse as she got older. It was one of the reasons we drifted apart. I was on the receiving end of her fantasies one too many times.
I don't see what that has to do with her being killed.
What started as simple fantasizing gradually took on a darker edge. I think she began to believe her own fairy tales. She started seeing enemies everywhere, imagining that people were whispering things behind her back, plotting against her.
In these times, she might have had a point.
Not the way you mean it. She was a paranoid delusional, Mr. Floyd. I have the medical files to prove it.
Olga reached into her handbag and produced a sheaf of papers.
You're welcome to examine them. Susan received treatment for her delusional problems throughout her 20s, up to and including electroconvulsive therapy. Needless to say, none of it worked.
Floyd took the papers and flicked through them. They looked convincing enough.
He passed them back to Olga, noticing as she took them that she had no rings on her fingers.
I'll take your word for it, he said. But what I don't understand is how your sister ended up in Europe, if she was so unwell.
In hindsight, it was a silly idea, Olga said, stuffing the medical papers back into her handbag. But she'd had a promising few months, and the doctors thought a change of scenery would do her even more good. She didn't have much money herself, but between us, the family was able to scrape together enough to put her on the boat and give her some pocket money to spend when she got here.
That must have been some pocket, Floyd said, remembering the rate at which Susan White had bought magazines and books.
I can't account for Susan's actions once she was here, Olga said. She could be very persuasive, and it's possible she may have exploited the good trust of other people to get what she wanted.
That's possible, Floyd allowed. Mind if I ask something that might sound a little indelicate?
I'm not easily offended.
How did you know she was dead if she was so out of touch?
From what we can tell,
Susan had almost no contact with anyone else in Paris. The authorities didn't know who she was and didn't care either. And yet you've arrived from Dakota just over 3 weeks after she died.
I didn't know she was dead until I reached the apartment building, Orga said. Her face was an unreadable mask. She might have been incensed or indifferent, for all Floyd could tell. But I had a very good idea that something must have happened to her. Susan didn't keep in touch with me, but she did send regular postcards back to our uncle in Dakota. He'd heard from her about once or twice a week since she arrived in Paris. So the postcards dried up. Not just that. The last few she sent showed signs that she was going off at the deep end again.
Orga paused and lit another cigarette. Floyd wondered why she bothered. She had barely smoked the last one.
She started going on about people being out to get her. The same old story, in other words. Everything we hoped she'd put behind her. Well, clearly she hadn't. But it was worse this time. As if in Europe her fantasies had come to full bloom. Nobody is the same person on vacation as they are at home, Mr. Floyd. We all change a little, sometimes for the better. With Susan it was very much for the worse.
What was in these postcards?
The usual stuff, only magnified. People shadowing her, people out to kill her. Conspiracies she saw all around her.
Was she in the habit of underlining things that mattered to her?
He caught a moment of doubt cross her face. Now and then, I suppose. Why?
Nothing, Floyd said, waving the question away. Passing thoughts.
Orga looked at the tin sitting on the desk between them. She mentioned that box. She said she had accumulated a lot of evidence and given it to her landlord for safekeeping.
But if she was delusional, none of the papers in that box are worth anything.
I'm not saying that they are, Orga answered. But Susan made a final request in one of the last postcards we got from her. It said that if anything was to happen to her, she wanted me to come and collect that box. She said it was the most important thing any of us could do for her, and she would die happy if she knew that the box would eventually end up in safe hands.
And did you answer her?
I sent a telegram back to her, saying I would collect the box should anything happen to her.
But you knew it was valueless. Are you seriously telling me that you came all the way across the Atlantic for a box full of worthless papers?
They weren't worthless to Susan, Orga said, with a bite in her voice. They were the most important things in her world, and I made a promise. I don't know about you, Mr. Floyd, but I don't break promises, no matter how pointless or absurd they might be.
Floyd reached out and pushed the tin across to Orga.
Then it's yours. I can't see any reason not to give it to you, especially after what you've just told me.
She touched the box guardedly, as if not quite believing her good luck.
You'll just let me walk out of here with this?
No questions asked.
Questions have been asked, Floyd said, and you've answered them to my complete satisfaction. I'll be honest with you. I looked through everything in that box and saw nothing of value. If I'd found cash or bearer's checks or the key to a safety deposit box, I might have wanted some more concrete proof that you are who you say you are. But a handful of old maps, some meaningless papers, and an expired railway ticket? You're welcome to it, Miss Auger. I just hope it brings your sister some peace, now that the box is back in family hands.
I hope it does, too, Auger replied. She picked up the box and slid it under her seat. There's just one more thing to deal with. You've been very reasonable, Mr. Floyd, and I'm sorry to take your case away from you as well.
My case? Floyd asked.
Like I said, there was no murder. My sister may have killed herself deliberately. She attempted suicide once before. Or she may have had an accident in her delusional state, imagining herself to be under attack. But the one thing I am absolutely certain of is that there was no murder, and therefore there is no murder case.
It's all right, Floyd said. The case closed itself the moment Blanchard hit that sidewalk.
Right, she said, nodding. You were his agents in the investigation?
Yes, and now that he's not around, there's no one to pay our expenses. Anyway, from what you say, there wasn't exactly a case to begin with.
Do you think Blanchard's death had anything to do with Susan's?
It's crossed my mind, Floyd said. One shouldn't speak ill of the dead, of course, especially of someone who's only been dead a matter of hours. But it occurs to me that maybe Blanchard had an idea of what had really happened all along. Maybe he felt he could have done more to help her, and that guilt began to weigh on his mind. In the end, it was too much for him to bear.
Then Blanchard killed himself because Susan died. Is that what you're saying?
The two deaths can't be unrelated, suggesting that the landlord killed himself as a result of some vague sense of responsibility might not satisfy a jury, but it's a lot neater than blaming some mysterious third party.
Look, Olga said, I'm sorry about the way this has happened. You've been the piggy in the middle of something that didn't concern you. She reached into her handbag and pulled out a plain manila envelope. She slid it across the table towards Floyd, who left it sitting there like a ticking bomb. It's not much, but I do appreciate your efforts. You looked after the box, after all, and I feel you deserve some kind of termination fee now that the case is closed. Floyd put his hand on the envelope, feeling its seductive plumpness. There were easily several hundred francs in it, maybe more. There's no need for this, he said. My contract was with Blanchard, not you. It's common human decency, Mr. Floyd. Please accept it. I talked to some of the people at the apartment building, and I know you've not been having an easy couple of days. Please accept this as recompense.
If you insist.
Floyd took the envelope and dropped it into the same desk drawer that had held the biscuit tin,
and I do appreciate the gesture.
Then we're done, I think, Olga said, standing up. She slipped her bag over her shoulder and tucked the tin under one arm.
Guess so, he replied, also standing.
She smiled. It was the first time he had seen any recognizable expression on her face. Somehow, I expected there would be more to it than this. Papers to sign, legal people to argue with. I didn't think I'd walk out of here with the tin without putting up a fight.
Like I said, it's just a tin with some papers in it. And I wouldn't want to make your life any more difficult than I have to. Losing a sister like that.
She reached across and took his hand. You've been very kind, Mr. Floyd.
Just doing my job.
I hope things work out for you and your partner. You deserve some good luck.
Floyd shrugged. Me and everyone else on the planet.
She turned around, looking back at him over her shoulder. Her hair framed her face in a nimbus of shining white, like the sun behind a thundercloud. Thank you again. I can see myself out.
It's been a pleasure doing business.
She paused at the door. Mr. Floyd, you never did tell me your Christian name.
Doesn't matter.
I'd like to know. You've been so kind, after all.
The name's Wendell.
Don't you like it?
It always sounded like a sucker's name to me. That's why my friends call me Floyd.
As a matter of fact, she said, I rather like it. Wendell seems such an honest sort of name. To me, at least.
Then to you, I'm Wendell.
In which case, goodbye, Wendell.
Goodbye, Miss Auger.
Verity, please, she said, correcting him, then walked out of the office, closing the door behind her. Floyd waited a moment and then slipped his hand into his pocket, reassuring himself that the postcard was still there. He liked her. She had the looks and seemed to be a nice enough lady, but he couldn't help wondering how she would have reacted if he'd mentioned Silver Rain.